Wonderful. So I'll get things started here. I'd like to call this September 2nd meeting of the Arizona State Board of Optometry to order at 8:11. Sorry for the tardy beginnings. Ms. Chavez,
I don't know if I'm here with you,
Margaret?
Yes, she's here.
Okay. Ms. Chavez, would you call roll, please?
Thank you, Madam President. Dr. Mascaras?
Here.
Dr. Cohen?
Present.
Dr. Carpenter?
Here.
Ms. Vaughn?
Here.
Dr. Moffitt?
Present.
Let the record show we have one vacant professional seat and one vacant public seat. Staff, Ms. Whalen?
Present.
Nope, Veronica Chavez is present. And then we'll counsel Mona Baskin.
Present, Mona Baskin present. Oh, I'm sorry, I scared her.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
We have time, Madam President.
Thank you. So we'll move on to agenda item C, meeting discussion and possible action on investigative reviews and complaints. Are there any conflicts of interest among the board members with any of the agendized complaints today?
No.
Okay. Thank you. I'd like to start then. Oh, and then also before we begin, if this is a virtual and telephonic meeting, I'd like all in attendance to preface their comments with their name so everyone knows who's speaking. And all patients should be referred to and refer to themselves by their initials in discussion. We'll start with agenda item C2, Dr. Stephen Wiseman, IR number 202302. And I'd like to start by asking, is patient TR present?
She is not present yet, Madam Chair.
Okay. Would you like me to reorder things, Margaret?
Yes, patient AP is present.
Okay. So we'll start with, so we'll change and we'll go to agenda item C1, Dr. Brian Farquhar, IR number 202301. So patient AP, I see that you're present here. Is Dr. Farquhar present? Okay, I hear nothing. So we'll move forward first with a board summary for this complaint, IR 202301. Can I ask one of the board members please to summarize for me? For the board. Dr. Carpenter, would you summarize, please?
Sure. So patient AP, it looks like originally presented at the office on June 3rd and was seen by Dr. Muscolino and looks like was given contacts, which were billed through her insurance, and then she was paying out of pocket for her glasses. And she had an old set of frames that she wanted the new lenses put in. So she signed the waiver saying that the lab or the office wouldn't be responsible for any damage done to the frames. But when the glasses came back, she was having trouble adapting to the new prescription. And then also she noticed a chip in the frame. So she did go back in a couple weeks later on the 15th. That's when she saw Dr. Farquhar and just for a follow-up, and he made some small changes to the prescription. When the glasses came back, she felt like the lenses were, they looked thick and seemed a little bit heavy, wasn't sure that they were done. Made as thin as they could have been, and that she had paid extra to have thinner lenses. And at that point, wanted a refund, but was told that that wasn't the office policy, that they would fix it, they would make it right, but they wouldn't refund the money. I think since then they have offered or said that they would refund the money, but that is where we stand.
Okay, thank you. And at this point, if patient AP would like to make any comments about this, please address your comments to the board.
Hello.
Hello, we hear you.
Hi, yeah. So I was never reached out to after that. When I spoke to the doctor on the phone, I initially called And we spoke on the phone for 30 minutes talking about what the issue could be with the glasses. And I had brought up a few questions asking for alternatives, and he said that I could get a refund. When I'd gone back in, I was told I couldn't get a refund. And that was the last time I ever spoke to anybody. Nobody ever reached out to me to resolve this issue still.
I have a quick question for you, patient AP. So I thought this also, when we got records, sometimes it's a little confusing to figure out exactly what happened, but you never went in and saw Dr. Farquhar, correct? You didn't see him for a re-refract on your glasses? You simply talked to him on the phone? That was the extent of your...
No, I did speak to him on the phone, and he was very reluctant to give me a refund. It was more forcefully like, we're going to get you another appointment, and we're just going to adjust the lenses again.
Okay.
But that still didn't solve my issue with the frames, and there was no real discussion on that when I had gone back in.
But you did go back in and see Dr. Farquhar, or you went back in and you saw an optician?
Yeah, I did go back in and I saw him.
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Does that conclude your comments towards the board?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And it looks like Dr. Farquhar still is not here, so we'll move forward then with board discussion. So I'll open this up for discussion amongst the board members only, please. Any comments from the board? Dr. Carpenter, since you don't have your mic off, I'll just start with you. Any comments?
Well, I certainly understand the frustration about the damage to the frame. That's always a tough situation when a patient wants to bring in, use their own frame. But that's why the waiver exists. And so I don't feel like that's really anything that, while it's unfortunate, I don't think anything wrong was done there. It just can happen in the course of fabricating new lenses for an older frame. As far as the prescription goes, sometimes it does take time to adapt to a new prescription. Sometimes things do need to be made. Changes need to be made. The prescription needs to be scaled back a little bit to help with adaptation. It sounds like part of AP's frustration is when the glasses were redone, they came back. She felt like they were heavy and thick and maybe not made as lightweight. We know that could be for several reasons. It could be the material. It could be maybe they used a different base curve than what she was accustomed to. And sometimes these things happen. Usually they're things that can be resolved as the patient works with the doctor. In this case, I agree that it probably would have been good to just go ahead and give her a refund and let her start fresh somewhere else. But I don't see any violations of the Optometric Care Act.
Okay, thank you. Other comments?
Hi, Dr. Mastoris. I can comment. In the stuff we received, I agree with everything Dr. Harpenser said, but it does look like so Dr. Farquhar is the doctor that wrote the prescription, I think, but the practice is Dr. Farr, I think. They did say in the stuff that they provided that they would issue a refund. So I also agree there's no violation to the Optometric Practice Act, but I would probably reach out to the practice to get a refund because I do think they will, looking at what they provided us, that probably is an option. So I just wanted the patient to know that we did receive that information.
Thank you, Dr. Mastoris. I have a few comments also that I would make here. Specifically towards patient AP, I agree with what Dr. Mastoris just said. I think if you reach out to the practice, they will offer you a refund now on the lenses. For future reference, when you have a prescription not turn out well, it is important to follow up for a re-refract with the doctor. A lot of the time, it's not the prescription itself. It is a problem with the material or the base curve of the lens, and it's hard to figure that out, and you could go through this sort of cycle when you purchase other glasses again if this isn't sort of narrowed down And so that's just a comment. It could be the prescription, but it could be other things, too, that you're having difficulty with. I have a bit of an issue, although I agree Dr. Farquhar never saw the patient. When the board reached out to Dr. Farquhar, he was resistant to provide any records and actually made it, I believe, somewhat difficult for the board to receive. So Margaret had requested multiple times, and he never provided records. Understandably, he didn't see the patient, but he also didn't let us know who saw the patient or give us any further information. And finally, when we reached out to the practice, we got the records, and that's how we found this out. So my suggestion, based on that, would be that we issue a letter of concern to Dr. Farquhar under Statute 32-1701, unprofessional conduct, N, for willfully and without legal justification failing to furnish in a timely manner information that is necessary for the board to conduct an investigation under this chapter and that has been requested or subpoenaed by the board. I think just a warning to Dr. Farquhar for some better cooperation in the future about providing us records or communicating where we might find the records is in order. Those are my comments. I'd like to ask Dr. Cohen also please to comment on the complaint.
Madam Chair, excuse me. Is your letter of concern for failure to provide records as requested?
It is. It's for, okay. For willfully not providing those records or, I want to look at the right wording. Failing to furnish in a timely manner information that is necessary for the board to conduct an investigation.
Okay, thank you. I just want to make sure it was complete before you went on to your discussion.
Yeah. Dr. Cohen, comments, please.
Yes, Dr. Moffitt, first of all, take on straight value about the delays that the State Board had in getting the information and your summary of that. I was not a party to it. It wasn't part of the discussion, but I would support that because I think it has to be very, very clear about the seriousness of the process and the need for it to be respected. So I think that would be appropriate. On the situation here, I think that the refund should take care of it separate from the unfortunate aggravation for everyone involved, particularly patient AP. I think that the refund will rectify and allow AP to move forward with care. And based on the description, I was reading what AP's complaints were completely reasonable for someone getting a new pair of glasses. And it had been alluded to before about the types of reasons. There's a laundry list of reasons why someone could be non-adaptive separate from the prescription being inappropriate. And it sounds as if there was some breakdown in communication based on confusing the factor of using a prior frame with a new prescription. And I think the doctor's office should be responsible to make sure that prescription is not only accurate, but also usable by the patient outside of the exam room and outside of what we call orthogaze, just looking straight ahead. So I did have a concern about the fact that it was, those two were conflated when it was separate issues.
Thank you, Dr. Cohen. I appreciate your comments. Ms. Galan, any comments?
I mean, I agree with most everything that's been said, and I'm on board with the letter of concern. I think that's important that we recognize, and if he recognizes moving forward, that when something's in front of the board, it's a serious thing. So,
thank you. I appreciate that. So I'll make a motion in this case to send a letter of concern to Dr. Farquhar regarding let me get my statute in front of me. Willfully and without legal justification failing to furnish in a timely manner information that is necessary for the board to conduct an investigation. And I'll call for a second.
This is Dr. Carpenter. I'll second that.
This is Dr.
Thank you. Any further discussion? And so we'll take a vote. Ms. Galan, how do you vote?
Yes, I have this is Dr. Cohen. I have a quick question for you.
Okay. Dr. Cohen, I'm sorry to say you're cutting out. I can't hear your discussion.
Are you able to hear me right now?
You're in and out.
Just barely. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
California, the Wi-Fi is not great here. I apologize. Yeah. I may wind up calling in if it continues. Are you able to hear me now?
Right now, I hear you.
Still breaking up?
A little.
Okay. I'll go quickly. I just had a quick question for Ms. Whalen and Dr. Moffitt. The issue of the refund, does that need to be addressed? Is it appropriate to be addressed, saying there seems to be a refund?
We cannot address it. That's something that the practice
in there at all?
Hopefully you heard me, Dr. Cohen. I said that the practice and the patient addressed that privately.
I did have that. Just wondering in terms of assurance that actually takes place.
Yeah, we can't do that. Okay. So I'm going to move forward then with a vote. Ms. Galan, how do you vote?
Aye.
Thank you. Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Thank you. Dr. Mastores?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 5-0. We'll move forward now with agenda item C2, I think. Are we still waiting on patient TR, Margaret?
We are, but Madam Chair, Dr. Rodney Taylor is present for C4 if you wanted to move to C, number
okay.
4 instead.
Sure. So let's move forward then. We'll call C4 Rodney Taylor, IR number 202304. Is patient ZX present? Okay, looks like no. And Dr. Taylor, I saw him. Oh, yep, I see him. Okay, he is present. So we'll open, please, with the board summary regarding Dr. Rodney Taylor, IR 202304. Can I ask someone from the board to summarize?
This is Dr. Mastores, I can summarize. So this is IR number 202304, patient ZX, and Dr. Taylor. The data service was July 11th of this year, and the patient complains of improper correction, refusal to give an RX, and rude and lie. The patient states that she had a very rushed exam. She was told to just pick the best one. She felt like she was rushed. She also felt that when she told the doctor that she had a special eye ink condition that she couldn't have a higher prescription, that it would cause headaches, that he said that he cannot do anything about it. It's illegal. She also stated that she was charged for a contact lens fitting but never received the contact lenses. And I do think there may have been a language barrier involved in this case. That's my summary.
Thank you. Dr. Taylor, would you like to take a moment and address the board regarding this complaint?
Yeah, I can. Can you all hear me?
Yes, we can.
I really don't have anything other to add other than my response to you all. We got as far as us actually trying the lenses on the patient. I had selected, I'm not sure what power I had selected for the patient. And that's when she said that she cannot accept anything higher than a -3, I think. When I left her in that contact lens dispensary to see the next patient, and when I came back out to assess those contacts on her, she had left the office. So it didn't give me a chance to fix her problem.
Okay. Does that conclude your comments, Dr. Taylor?
Yes.
Thank you. So I'll open this up then for board discussion only. Board members, any comments regarding this complaint? I'll start with my own comments, and then I'll warn everyone I'm going to call on you also. So there were just a few things here. One, my impression, at least with this, and I'm glad you're here, Dr. Taylor. I'm going to address some of this towards you. But, of course, if you have a patient who says something like, over a minus three, I get severe headaches, they're practically describing a binocular vision disorder to you. And so there's probably something to that, which is fine if you want to try something above it and then say, you know, let's tease it down or let's see, right? Let's check your vision maybe with a minus three and see what kind of distance vision you have for driving and things like that. But I think saying anything like, no, I can't, it did seem just a touch stubborn, and maybe that's just the way that it came off in the record. But there are reasons for people, you know, to get headaches with a power too high. I have patients that they refract to a certain level, and I always have to back off the prescription a quarter to a half diopter so that they can function reasonably. And, you know, like I said, they're describing either a convergence or accommodation issue, but they don't know how else to articulate it. And so I thought that was something that probably needed to be addressed, and that's my impression here. My only other issue with the records was that in one area in the record you write DPAs used, but we have no idea what that means. DPAs for pressures, DPAs for dilation, what was the drug and what was the concentration? So I can't tell if this patient was dilated or not dilated, although you had a retinal exam, but it didn't tell me. And, of course, that's part of your record that you're supposed to use if you put any drops in the IA, you have to keep a record of that. And so I would just caution you for future reference that that needs to be specific. Those were my impressions and my thoughts. I'm going to open this up now. Dr. Mastores, any comments?
I agree. I think that I probably would have tried the minus three on her eyes and taken acuity just to sort of see what she could see with that. Always a proponent of 20 happy. I do think there was a miscommunication as well. Just difficulty with communicating with the language barrier perhaps. I agree with what Dr. Moffitt said. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Carpenter, comments?
Yes, I agree with what yourself and Dr. Mastores have said. It did come across a little bit rigid, his response as far as not being able to try or being legally obligated to give her what he found that day. I agree that he could have tried a minus three in the exam room and showed it to her and said, this is what your vision would be like, and then have a discussion there. There may, as was mentioned, there may have been a little bit of a language barrier that made it more difficult. And like he said, with the patient's frustration, the fact that she left, he didn't have a chance to work with her on that. But I do agree, we don't need to be so rigid or, sometimes as doctors, when the patient comes in kind of telling us what they need, sometimes we can take offense to that, you know, because we're the doctor, but we do need to defer to their experience and understand that there can be some merit in what they're saying.
Thank you. Ms. Galan, comments?
Yeah, I mean, I agree, I think, with everything that's been said, and I don't have anything further to add at this time.
Okay. Dr. Cohen, comments?
Yes, this is Dr. Cohen. I think Dr. Carpenter raised a very interesting point about that. one of the things that, and this is not based on the statutes, but that the perception of our own ego is getting in the way. I see a patient coming in who's describing a prior history where there may have been issues, even with novel changes in prescription, as a treasure trove of information. Hopefully I can learn from and not repeat. So although Dr. Taylor was kind enough to the auto refraction, final refraction, and historical refraction, and doesn't show a big difference. There is a slight change in astigmatism. There is a small change, and there are people that will describe some of the things that this patient described in terms of distortion that could have been changed, but I recommend being more flexible in attempting things and see where it leaves you. It may leave in situations comfortable for the patient. As far as the contact lens fee, I agree with Dr. Taylor that we can't consider a contact lens prescription completed until and available for a copy to the patient until that process has taken place, which was short-circuited for reasons unknown right now. So I don't see a violation of the statute here.
Thank you, Dr. Cohen. You cut off just at the end there, but I did hear you say you didn't see a violation of the statutes. I agree also with that. I believe we, well, we'll see. But I also agree I see no violation. One just comment I would make just as a colleague to Dr. Taylor is that if the patient left after the exam and you really didn't end up doing a contact lens fit, which it sounds like you didn't because the patient left, I probably would make an effort to go talk to my biller and just say refund this as an act of goodwill and maybe to try and remedy the situation. That would be my own approach. So I just offer that up because I think that also when I'm looking through this. Would anyone like to make a motion, please?
Dr. Mastouris, I motion to dismiss as there's no violation of the Optometric Practice Act.
Thank you. Is there a second? Thank you. Any further discussion? Okay. So we'll vote. Dr. Mastouris moved to dismiss the complaint against Dr. Taylor as there's no violation of the Optometric Practice Act. Ms. Galan, how do you vote?
Aye.
Thank you. Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mastouris?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 5-0. Thank you, Dr. Taylor, for your attendance. Let's see here.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
If I may make a request, if it pleases the board, could we still take Eric Johansson first to give patient TR just a little more time to appear?
Sure.
If not, we can just move on, and that will be okay. That.
Gotcha. So agenda item C3, Dr. Eric Johansson, IR number 202303. Is patient JT present? I don't think so. And Dr. Johansson? Not present, I don't think. Okay. So can I have a board summary in IR number 202303, Dr. Johansson? I think I'll offer this one. Patient JT was evaluated at Cochise Eye and Laser with Dr. Johansson on March 11, 2022. Patient signed a notice of exclusion of Medicare benefits detailing that a refraction is an uncovered service or procedure with Medicare. He was informed there would be a $35 refraction fee if he requested a refraction. I think the gist of this is that patient JT feels like this is an unfair practice. Okay. I'll open this up for board discussion. Any comments?
I can comment. This is Dr. Carpenter. This is a common one that comes up before the board. It is true that Medicare covers the medical aspects of the exam, but not the refraction. So it's common practice for the office to explain this up front and to have the patient sign accepting responsibility for the refraction. On occasions, patients will decide to not do the refraction, but it is a pretty integral part of the exam. It sounds like in this case, the patient did not want that. They didn't want to pay the extra amount, and so that part of the exam was not performed. Sounds like there was a little bit of confusion where the patient was under the impression that the optical would credit that, or they would waive that fee if he purchased their glasses there, which that does sound a little fishy. The doctor did say that that's not the case. They do not waive that, and I'm sure that – I know that that's not standard practice to do that. So I think that was probably just a bit of a misunderstanding, but overall the frustration was just over the fact that he had to pay and the perception that he was being forced to pay just to get a copy of his record or of his prescription, when in fact the payment is to actually have that part of the test performed. So basically what I'm saying is this is common misunderstanding, but there's no violation of the statutes.
Thank you.
As is Dr. Mastoris, I completely agree. It's frustrating when insurance doesn't cover things, but it is what it is, and we have to work within those parameters. So I also see no violation.
Thank you. Dr. Cohen?
Yes, I think that's one of the more challenging things that we have to be able to explain the way benefits work. Most of those patients that come in are actually more interested in the refraction than the eye health part, because that's the part that usually drives them into the office. So when they find that that's separate, I can see where that would be a source of confusion and possibly an issue between. I did have a concern about patients' perception that whatever amount was going toward that was going to be offset if they bought the glasses there. Any office has the right to give a discount on glasses, whether it's for seniors, whether it be for cash pay. Those are not unreasonable things that are done, but I think it's inappropriate if anyone in the office is giving the impression that is tied into the Medicare fee for the refraction. It may wind up being an equivalent amount, but those have to be kept very, very separately because we, from my understanding, we don't only have the responsibility to bill for the out-of-pocket expense from Medicare, we have a responsibility to attempt collection of it. And I think anything that comes across as well, we're just going to discount it on this and maybe out of line.
Thank you, Dr. Cohen. Part of what you said, I think, is really important, and I'll just repeat from my perspective that we are expected also by insurance when you contract with insurance to bill for a non-covered benefit if you provide it. And so that can also get us in trouble if we waive a fee for something we've contracted to bill for when we're contracted with insurance. So I think that's missed sometimes in this discussion, but a very important element of it, of course, that we have to abide by the rules that we have signed up or contracted with insurance to follow. So I'll also say I see no violation of the Optometric Practice Act. Would anyone like to make a motion?
This is Dr. Carpenter. I will motion that we dismiss this case on the grounds that there's been no violation of the Optometric Practice Act.
Thank you. I'll
second.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Okay, hearing none, we'll vote. We've had a motion to dismiss as there's no violation of the Optometric Practice Act. Ms. Galan, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mastoris?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 5-0. So we'll move forward with agenda item C2, Dr. Stephen Weissman, IR number 202302. Patient TR, I don't believe, is present. And then Dr. Weissman, also I do not believe is present. Can we have a board summary here? Dr. Cohen, would you like to offer a board summary, please?
Yes, this is Dr. Cohen. Dr. Moffitt, I'll give it a try. My Wi-Fi is slow, so I have another computer to review the notes. This involved a patient using their own frames. There was a $140 deposit for lenses that was put down, and then a lot of back and forth with based on the breakage of the frame, which can happen even after a signage was they signed off on that. The patient now still hasn't received the money back and is frustrated that it's taken this long and wants to be able to does want to go back there to take care of it, wants the refund to be made whole to be able to seek care elsewhere. Going down to the response. So there's a recommendation to recheck, and that the recheck by the doctor that would be done at no charge, and that she had her glasses, but I think that she was dissatisfied with the way they looked, and that the optician has made efforts and the office made efforts to not only refund any out-of-pocket expense, but to get a credit back from IMED so that the patient could seek care elsewhere. So I think that they've since made an effort to be able to rectify the situation for the patient.
Thank you. Thank you. So I'll open this up for board discussion now. Any comments from the board?
This is Dr. Carpenter. In addition to the summary that Dr. Cohen provided, I think another element here is the patient was a little frustrated that she was told that, according to her words, that she could no longer wear contacts because her eyes were, I think she just said, you know, her language is just because my eyes are really bad, but then went to a different doctor and was told, oh, yes, you can wear contacts. And so that added to the patient frustration, which I can understand. In reviewing Dr. Wiseman's notes, he had seen the neovascularization of the cornea due to the overwear of the contacts, and he wasn't saying she could never wear contacts, but rather wanted her to wear glasses for 2 months, let her eyes kind of rest, and then reevaluate things in 2 months. So I think there was a little bit of miscommunication there, or perhaps the patient was just frustrated because of what happened with the breaking of the frame and frustrated that she couldn't wear contacts. But I don't see any violations here of the Practice Act.
I agree. I think it's notable on the record. I'm sorry. I'll finish just a second, Dr. Cohen, that the patient also wearing extended wear and she was sleeping in colored contact lenses. And so there's a good history there for some neovascularization. And it kind of looked like when I reviewed Dr. Wiseman's record that he did everything appropriately. So that was my impression also. I also saw no violation of the Optometric Practice Act. Dr. Cohen, I'm sorry, I'll hand it over to you.
How's it going?
I'm sorry, Dr. Cohen, you're cutting out again.
In the records, although it's happening. Like, is this any better?
It is.
Is it any better
now? It is
now?
Right now.
I'll go quickly. In the records, fortunately, this is one time the records do support what was discussed. It says, although it's handwritten, so some of it's hard to read, it says no recheck in 2 months and no sleeping in contact lenses. So that is consistent with what we might tell a patient on a temporary basis who has neo, that we then say that this doesn't take you out of the game from being able to wear contacts. It just means pause. Better. So I feel like things were handled appropriately somewhere in communication of what they represented.
I agree. Ms. Galan, any comments?
No, not really. I agree with what's been said.
Okay. Would anyone like to make a motion?
Dr. Mastoris, I will make a motion to dismiss that there is no violation of the Optometric Practice Act.
Thank you. Is there a second? Thank you, Dr. Cohen. Seconded. Any further discussion? All right. We'll vote. So we have a motion to dismiss as there is no violation of the Optometric Practice Act. Ms. Galan, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mastoris?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 5-0. So move forward to agenda item D, review discussion and possible action on approval of continuing education as provided by ARS 32-1704D and AAC R4-21-210. Agenda item A, FACO or LPI, reviewing the management of chronic angle closure glaucoma, the latest in intraocular lens options for patients with cataracts by Trent Bowen at Saguaro Ophthalmology. The CE date for this is October 5th, 2022, and it's requested 2 regular CE hours for this. Any discussion among the board as this is continuing education, as far as the content of this continuing education?
This is Dr. Carpenter. I was really impressed with the slides. It looked really good.
I agree. I liked it, too. I thought it looked like a really good lecture. I see Dr. Mastoris shaking her head. Yes. Dr. Cohen, any thoughts on the CE? Shaking his head. Yes. Ms. Galan?
I thought it was very well.
Okay, wonderful. Would someone like to make a motion?
This is Dr. Carpenter. I can make a motion. Let's see. The motion would be to approve this continuing education course for continuation credit. Did I say that correctly?
I think so. Second? Any seconds?
I'll second.
Thank you. So we have a motion to approve FACO or LPI as a continuing education lecture, for 2 hours on October the 5th. So we'll vote. Ms. Galan, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mestoras?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 5-0. I'd like to take a motion, take a moment here and dismiss our translator for the rest of the meeting.
Oh, should I go?
Yes, I'll finish. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye. Okay. We'll move on to agenda item E, review, discussion, and possible action on approval of testing centers for proctoring or of jurisprudence exam pursuant to AAC R421-203C. Agenda item 1, Utah State University statewide campuses in Utah. Are there any concerns with approving Utah State University as a proctoring site?
This is Dr. Carpenter. I have no concerns.
Okay. But anyone like, I see everyone shaking their head no. Dr. Cohen should have said no. Dr. Mestoras, no. Ms. Galan, also no. Would anyone like to make a motion? I would move to accept Utah State University, the statewide campuses in Utah, for a testing center for proctoring of our jurisprudence exam. Is there a second?
This is Dr. Carpenter. I'll second it.
Okay. Thank you. Any further discussion? Okay. We'll vote. Ms. Galan, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mestoras?
Aye.
And I also vote aye. Motion passes 5-0. Agenda item F, review, discussion, and possible action regarding sunset review, agency continuation, and statute updates. So we'll open this up for discussion. We're going to review statutes today and changes in language. And then discuss anything that we think is relevant and gather our thoughts. So starting with, this is chapter 16, Article 1, General Provisions. So we have some potential changes here, starting at the top. Wonderful, Margaret. Definitions. And so we can see any proposed changes have an underlined area. And any comments we may want to add or change, this is our time to discuss and to communicate. I'm just going to open this, and I invite anyone on the board who has comments to make, please offer your comments. I'm going to try to move us through it. I don't mean to talk over anybody. Please just start speaking if you have a comment to make. So with number 1, board means the State Board of Optometry, no changes here. I'm not going to go through every sentence that doesn't have changes. I only bring that one up because I thought maybe this should say board means the Arizona State Board of Optometry. That's the only thing that I thought that word Arizona might be in there. And Margaret, you please also, if you have any comments or anything to offer to the board during discussion, please feel free. Same with you, Mona. Number 2, we have some changes there. Any comments regarding definition number 2? I thought that we could also include a bandage contact lens in that comment. That maybe it should also say bandage.
Where would that be, Dr. Moffitt?
So I put it just instead of or. It would end, the term includes any plain old lens, comma, cosmetic lens, or bandage lens. Any comments from any of the board? Okay.
Yes. So I have one question with the future heading toward, this is Dr. Cohen, with future heading toward contact lens being used as a delivery system, perhaps for medications, does the fact that it has any plano lens, are we assuming that that covers that area?
Maybe we should write a therapeutic lens instead of bandage. That would encompass bandage or any medical delivery system. Agreed?
I like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Okay. Any other comments?
Dr. Moffitt?
Yes.
This is Dr. Carpenter. Just for context, what does the term sunset review mean?
So we just went through our audit, and so the sunset review gave us some changes they would like to see the board make in our language and then in our practices. And so some of that is incorporated into the changes in language that you see in the statutes.
And then the language, the changes that have been made, did they make those, or did you make those, or did Margaret make those?
They made those changes to us. They suggested these changes to us, and so we're trying to be compliant then with those changes.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the board, if I could add just a little bit to what Dr. Moffitt said for you, Dr. Carpenter, the sunset review actually refers to every state agency. Every 10 years, we're required to go through the legislature and basically defend our position as to why we should exist as an agency, which is, are we protecting the public? Is the board meeting its mission? Are we doing what we're supposed to? And part of that process, like Dr. Moffitt said, is the audit. So the big, we call it the big audit. The Auditor General's office comes in and they spend anywhere from 3 to 6 months with the agency just asking for absolutely everything that we have. And then they make recommendations based on their findings. So this language that is proposed here is actually a language that I have researched and put in. And part of my research was all of our collegial boards across the U.S. and Canada, just kind of what's trending in the industry, stuff I've heard through ARBO, through AOA, from the AZOA, who we partner with, as you know, which also I'd like to address real quickly, Dr. Meyer. Don Isaacson and Marie Isaacson, I'm going to send you this. I just couldn't send it prior to the board meeting, so I'll make sure to include you with all my changes. And also today's review, Dr. Carpenter and members of the board, is just that. This is the very first time you guys are all looking at this. I just want you to look at it for clarity of the language. All we're trying to do is get authority to enforce something. So when you think about our statutes, that's what gives us the authority to do all the stuff that we do at every board meeting. And then any rules that are resultant from a statute, we'll do those later because the rules is a separate process. It's similar but separate. So the rules would not be until next year because this will not go before the legislature until January of next year. Is that helpful?
Yes, very much so. Thank you.
So, again, these are all my changes, and as you know, I'm not an optometrist. I do my best. So when you're thinking about the changes that are here, you know, from the professional's perspective, I would ask you to just make sure that it is accurate, that it says what we want it to say, that we're not, you know, outside of our scope or anything like that, because we're not doing a scope extension this year. I did speak with the AZOA, and they have gone to the national associations, and it's not really a good environment right now for this upcoming session, but maybe in 2024 we'll look at that. So, and for Ms. Galan, my public members, you're a layperson just like I am, so if anything looks out of place, we just need to look at that as well.
Thank you, Margaret.
Okay,
thank you very much.
Okay.
Sure.
So we'll move on to number 3, the contact lens prescription. The only thing that I thought should be added there is in the last sentence, if applicable, the prescription may also include diameter, axis, add power, cylinder, peripheral curve, optical zone. It should also say edge treatment or coating. I added those. Any other comments? You could just put a comma there, Margaret. And maybe you intend to come back and audit this, but I just saw your changes. It could just say edge treatment, comma, coating, or center thickness. But the where it says or coating, oh, okay. I would just eliminate that. Yeah.
All right, I didn't know if those
were. Nope, that's okay. I'm just trying to be helpful as we go through it, I guess.
Yes, definitely. I appreciate that.
Okay. And then any comments about sentence 5, dispensing? Anybody speak up as soon as they have anything to say. All right. Moving on, number 6, fitting. Nope. Number 8, ophthalmic goods. Number 9, ophthalmic services. Number 10, ophthalmic lens. All right. The next sentence with changes. Number 13, practice of profession of optometry.
Madam President, if I could just interject. Mm-hmm. Again, this is simply an update to our language. Our language has been there for at least 20 years. I'm not saying it's not good, the language that we have. I just felt like it needed a little bit of an update, but if you feel like it doesn't, I'm not married to any of the changes I made, so please, we don't have to keep anything that I have in here. So okay. Please do speak up if you have any issues.
I will. I just reiterate.
I'm talking to the rest of the board.
Yep, anybody else on the board, speak up as soon as you have any comment to make, please. I'll just immediately stop talking. In A, the examination diagnosis, it says, and treatment of abnormal conditions. I just thought it should say of normal and abnormal conditions and diseases of the eye. It's Adnexa and visual systems because, of course, we do a lot of exams for normal.
You're saying of normal and abnormal?
Yes. Okay. That was it for me. Any other comments? 6B, 6C, 6D, 6E?
Dr. Ma. For one quick question, is there anywhere it should say when talking about diagnosis and treatment of saying or where applicable appropriate referral?
Well, I think we have statutes regarding referral, so.
We do.
Yeah, I didn't think necessarily that needed to be added there. Do you have a specific place you think in there, Dr. Cohen?
It was just under A. I didn't read where the book ends. So I didn't see where it comes in later, but
okay.
Just that's the one place, but yeah. I'm fine.
Okay.
Well, I'll make a note of that, Dr. Cohen, because it's possible that we could repeal the referral statute and just add it. Although I think the referral statute, and Ms. Baskin has stepped out. She has a hearing at the moment, but she'll be back. The statute by itself might be stronger, so it depends what her thoughts are. We may leave it and just not include it, or we can just include it here and repeal that section. So thank you. I'll make a note.
Okay. F. Sentence G. I was trying to think about this sentence G. So practice, going back to the header, practice of the profession of optometry occurs when a person employs primary human eye care procedures, including, and then it says G, any laser procedure as set forth by the board's rules and not excluded under subsection A of this. So I had two thoughts on this. One, that sentence, if we're adding lasers, then it may say any laser and injectable. That would be one way to write it. But then, of course, that sounds a lot like scope expansion that we don't have at present. Or we could simply leave it any procedure as set forth by the board's rules and not excluded under subsection A, so that if there is board expansion in the future, if it says just procedure, then that automatically includes it.
That's a good point, Dr. Moffitt. It can go either way because we would just amend that if our scope was amended as well, but that's definitely better. I mean, the less you change, the better. So
I just thought that simplified it but would encompass any of those.
Okay, changes. Perfect. The next section, I just wanted to preface that by saying, you know, historically we don't include as much detail in statute because that's what rules are for. And sometimes it's better to not have a list of something because you may inadvertently exclude something. But in this case, you know, I'd say over the past 3 to 5 years, the board has been getting an exceeding amount of phone calls asking about this procedure, that procedure. Are we able to, can we bill for it? So I just felt like maybe if we were able to sort of give some guidance as to what is excluded, that might be helpful. So again, this section may or may not be, you know, good to apply at this point in time. That's totally up to you all.
Okay.
So keep that in mind when you're reviewing this next section, please.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's tricky. In section A, capital A, the following ophthalmic procedures shall be excluded from the authorized practice of optometry. And it says the following general procedures. It says administration of general anesthesia, surgery performed with general anesthesia. I will just make a comment that most ophthalmic procedures, cataract surgery, retina surgery, all of that, are usually done with block and IV sedation. So almost none are done with, I don't know any that are done with general anesthesia. So I'm not sure that this is applicable to us. Yeah. And then, okay. I'm sorry. Yeah, okay. I'm sorry about that. But yeah, I was looking at that and it just, it doesn't apply necessarily. And then, the following, and then any board members, please speak up. I'm just trying to move us through this like any agenda. So if there are any comments along the way, please just interrupt me and speak. The following laser procedures. So corneal procedures, you know, I look at this and interpret that as sort of LASIK and PRK is, I think, what you're trying to get at. Procedures of the vitreous of the eye for the purpose of treating any retinal or macular disease. So injections into the posterior segment, I think, is what you're getting at. Retinal procedures. This doesn't have, and I'm wondering if we're listing things like surgeries or laser procedures to the anterior chamber or iris, like SLT, ALT, or LPI. So I'm not sure if you meant that, the anterior chamber and iris. Right now, those are, so that's fairly exclusive. Any comments there from anybody? Do we want that list? Do we not want that list?
Yeah, I agree on the under that heading, laser procedures, procedures of the vitreous chamber. I wasn't sure what that was really referring to.
Right.
So if we define that a little bit better. Shorter.
I think when I see that, I think of these people trying to use a laser to eliminate floaters. That's
exactly.
What
that's what came to my mind.
Going on with that, yeah.
Playing asteroids.
Uh-huh.
So does that need to be removed or reworded?
There really is no procedure with laser to the vitreous chamber that exists in its present form. Okay. Retina or macular disease, that does exist.
Okay, so procedures.
I mean, if we wanted to explicitly rule out trying to hit floaters with a YAG laser,
right.
you could say that.
Yeah.
But I don't know that we need to.
Yeah. There's really nothing like that approved for vitreous floaters treatment right now.
Okay. Is it accurate? Is number two accurate the way it is now? Procedure for the purpose of treating retinal or macular disease?
Yes.
Okay.
I think it is. And then you have retinal procedures there a second time, so you probably don't need to have that number three, retinal procedures. Okay. All right. So we all feel comfortable with that list as it's written? Okay.
Yes.
All right. Okay. And so now it's B on our screens in front of us. But I'm going to be off on my lettering here, so I just have to watch. The following non-laser procedures. So number eight was the only one that I thought we should discuss. It says surgery requiring full thickness incision. The following non-laser procedures. Let's see. These should be excluded from the authorized practice of optometry. So we have paracentesis on there. But it says surgery requiring full thickness incision or excision of the cornea or sclera other than paracentesis in an emergency requiring immediate reduction of pressure inside of the eye. I'm not sure that I think paracentesis should be an exception, even in an emergency. So, and I'll say why I think this. Because, of course, I think this comes up because optometrists are seeing one-day post-ops, and there's already a corneal incision made into the eye. And so if you have a raised pressure, then, of course, sometimes you have to paracentesis the eye just to release the pressure. However, in that instance, I'm not sure that's really an emergency. But I understand people wanting to do paracentesis under those conditions. There's already a corneal incision made. However, this could be interpreted if you had a patient in your chair with a pressure spike. We have medications, carbonic anhydrase inhibitors, that we can give orally already in this situation to bring the pressure down. But I would not think it appropriate for someone to paracentesis the eye in an emergency situation like this. Because there's a risk of endophthalmitis, I don't think an optometrist should be doing that. And so I don't think it should be worded quite like that. I think that's kind of risky wording. If we want to get paracentesis, I think that it needs to be separate, and it needs to be discussed under which conditions it would be done. A one-day post-op is a totally different situation than creating your own portal and paracentesing the eye. Any comments?
Just read better, Dr. Moffitt.
Let's see.
Students in optometry school, they're not being trained on how to do a paracentesis, are they, currently?
I don't believe so. I mean, they may be doing it clinically, you know, when they're looking at a one-day post-op. If they have if they have an ophthalmologist right there, they may be teaching them how to do this. But, you know, again, if someone's in solo practice and they just decide to paracentesis an eye, this is a huge potential issue.
I agree. When I read that the other day, I thought, wow, I didn't know we
No, we can't. Yeah, we can't. And it's different to paracentesis when you already have a corneal incision than it is to create your own. So this is that's how I feel like that reads.
I agree. Yeah, I give that impression that we should all be ready and waiting to paracentesis if we have to.
Yeah, and we already have medication that we can use this. So I don't think anybody should be paracentesis an eye.
So I removed that section, but does it still read properly? Like, can it be assumed that the paracentesis is not, or it's not included, or it's excluded?
Read the whole
Well, that whole emergency part requiring immediate reduction of pressure, that all can come off, right?
Okay.
Surgery requiring full thickness incision or excision of the cornea or sclera.
Yep, I agree.
Just like that?
Yep.
Perfect. Okay.
I think so, too. I agree. Any other comments, other board members? Okay. Shaking head no. All right. Okay. So I think everything else there was okay. In number 14, I just saw a spelling error. It says ocular instead of ocular disease. I just thought I'd point it out while we were here.
Sorry about that.
No.
Thank you for noticing.
Yeah. Okay. How are we on time? Okay. So, page 4. So I didn't disagree with any. I like the rewording, Margaret. So I didn't disagree with any of the removed sentences. Anybody else? Any comments there on what was removed? Okay.
Yeah, so that was kind of a bigger update because that, like I said, this law has to be 20 years or more older.
Yeah, I like the new language. I think it's much more clean.
Okay, thank you.
So number 14, surgery, where it says surgery means a procedure using instruments, including lasers, scalpels, or needles, in which human tissue is cut. I think cut should say opened because I think that's much more straightforward. When you have an abrasion and you have loose tissue to debride and that kind of thing and you have to take off this hanging tissue that is wrinkly and ripped, I think that, you know, people can make the argument that cut is different, but opened, if you are opening tissue, that's different. And so I thought that word was much more straightforward.
I like it.
Okay. Any other comments from the board? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's good because then it goes on to further defining it, that it would need to be closed by mm-hmm. suturing and clamping.
Yep, I liked that too. I thought that was much more clean. And in the last sentence, it says the term does not include a non-invasive procedure to remove a superficial foreign body in the conjunctiva, eyelid, or cornea. And I think it should stop at cornea, as opposed to saying epithelium that has not perforated the Bowman's membrane. Because if you have an abrasion, it's very hard to judge. If you have, you know, we're talking about 50 microns here and another 8 microns. And so this is very hard to judge that, and I think that sets an undue limit there that is really not applicable. So I would just say that it ends at cornea. Any comments there?
I was just curious, is there any language written, like, as far as, is there a limit to what we're able to do? I mean, obviously, if there's a foreign body that's perforated the globe, I'm sure, you know, we would not be advised to remove that. That'd be without our scope, outside our scope, but.
Yep. I'll address that.
Depending on the depth of that, mm-hmm. I guess we're not limited.
Well, so I think that we are limited, but we're limited by these words, non-invasive, mm-hmm. and let me see here, and you don't have to close it. If you had a perforated injury, obviously you have to close the globe. That's going to require suturing and other things, and so there is a limit. Sure. It says superficial, and it says non-invasive, but that leaves you a little room to wiggle, right? How are you ever going to say, this was only epithelium and it was not Bowman's, or it was Bowman's, but it wasn't stroma. So my point is it's overly specific, but the terms non-invasive and superficial are already still a part of that and already define it. So that was my interpretation. I thought the same thing, but I wanted it to be a reasonable, you know, it needs to be within reason and clinically applicable. So.
That was an excellent explanation, Madam Chair. And members of the board, Madam President, if I could just clarify a little bit. I know it's tricky when you're looking at statutes and rules, but especially statutes. The key here is that when statutes are written, it's completely black and white. It either says you can do this and only this, or you cannot do that and only that. So there's no interpretation. Sometimes doctors will call and say, well, it doesn't say that I can't. And I'm like, but it doesn't say that you can. That's kind of how it's interpreted. It's a little bit illogical, I guess. So Dr. Carpenter, if that helps a little bit to sort of interpret, because Dr. Moffitt was spot on in her explanation. Does that help you?
Oh, yeah. No, it makes sense. Yeah, thank you.
Of course. I have a lot of newbies, so I got to take care of you guys. Your first go around.
Well, I'm a new to this also, so.
I know you are, but yes.
Hi, this is Dr. Cohen. I have one quick question that doesn't always fall into surgery, but anywhere in here that talks about our allowance to be able to use amniotic tissue?
It's not expressly stated, yeah, anywhere.
Does that become a situation?
If you have the suture, so it depends on how you applied that amniotic membrane. If you applied it with a bandage lens, right, versus if you had to suture it in place. So if you can't suture it, right, so if you had a pterygium removal and you needed to suture an amniotic membrane over the defect, you cannot. If you are applying it with a bandage contact lens over a corneal wound and you're using that bandage lens for therapeutic reasons, I don't know why you could not. So that's the way I interpret what I've read. Margaret, do you have any thoughts on that?
Are you talking about titrating the blood and things like that too?
So you can use an amniotic membrane simply over like a corneal epithelial defect that's non-healing, just to try and get it to heal.
How is it applied? I think the key is how is it applied and how is it removed if it's removed?
You can put a bandage lens over it, and that holds it up against the corneal epithelial defect. And so in that instance, you're simply just using like a prosthetic almost. But if you have to suture it onto the eye, then mm-hmm. that is different.
Well, let me ask Dr. Cohen this question. What's your intent with your question, Dr. Cohen? Are you looking for a specific type of application or procedure regarding it, or just the use of it altogether?
Yes, Ms. Whelan, this is Dr. Cohen. It was in reading this, in particular your comment about not being open for interpretation, that it's written as it is written. Want to make sure they weren't backing into a situation where a claim could be made that whether it's amniotic tissue used that's dehydrated with a contact lens or something like Procara, which is actually a foreign device put on the eye that has a ring with the amniotic tissue in it. I want to make sure we weren't leaving it open that inadvertently we'd no longer be able to do something that we're doing now.
Well, that would be under like our use of pharmaceutical agents or other drugs. It doesn't specifically apply to this particular instance since it could be applied using the bandage lens, as we talked about earlier, Dr. Cohen. So I think in that particular instance, you're all good to go. It really just depends where it falls in our prescribing authority or use of medications.
Thank you, Ms. Riley.
Does that? Okay. If I'm not clear, just let me know because I do this all day for a living. So sometimes it makes perfect sense to me, but I might not be explaining it. So thank you, Dr. Cohen.
Okay. All right. So then moving on, I didn't have any other changes on the whole rest of the page under unprofessional conduct.
Madam President, I did add, I revised at the request of our board counsel. Okay. Item here under the unprofessional conduct, Ms. Baskin felt that the way it was currently written was a little bit ambiguous and vague for that matter, and didn't really give us the authority to promulgate a rule that may support it should we need to. So I did change the language to read sexually harassing a patient, former patient, research subject, supervisee, or coworker for the purposes of this section. Sexually harassing includes sexual advances, sexual solicitation, requests for sexual favors, unwelcome comments or gestures, or any other verbal or physical conduct of a sexual nature. This is language that a couple of other boards have. It's very similar to their language. So, but again, these are our statutes. So if you don't like this language or you feel like it needs to be revised, again, I will definitely entertain any changes. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have anything at this moment, I encourage the board members, just in case I forget to tell you later, please just email me anytime with any suggested language or removal so we can discuss it at a board meeting.
I have a question about how this reads because we had sexual intimacies with the patient in the course of care or treatment. So are we mm-hmm. saying now that you can have a personal relationship with a patient?
Well, that was my question, and Ms. Baskin, like I said, has stepped away for another hearing, so maybe we could revisit because that was one of the things I had brought up. So I can't answer that at the moment, Dr. Moffitt. Can we revisit that in a little bit when she comes back? Okay.
I mean, frankly, you can look at this a couple of ways. I've done an eye exam on my husband, right? And so that's really nothing wrong with that. But if a doctor-patient relationship starts, a personal relationship starts, you know, while you're treating, do we think that that should continue? So I don't know. It does seem like a question to me.
Okay.
Well, and to follow up on that, this is Dr. Carpenter. It says, for the purpose of this section, sexually harassing includes sexual advances, solicitation. Would you just want to put includes unwanted or non-consensual or you know what I'm saying?
This is Dr. Cohen. That's an interesting point, Dr. Carpenter. It does say unwelcome comments, but my only concern with that, some of them very specific, but if, say, the doctor finds some attraction to the patient and asks that patient out to meet for lunch or dinner, could that fall under the category of an unwelcome comment that might put someone in violation of the code on the board?
Well, it's definitely subjective. I mean, that's the issue with any kind of situation, you know, like this. But I'm thinking about Dr. Carpenter's comments real quick.
Yeah, I think Dr. Cohen kind of answered the more general question of, I don't know, it seems kind of harsh that, I mean, I'm married, so I'm not looking to, you know, find, that's not my dating pool, you know, my patients, but you would hate for a doctor to be in violation or their license in jeopardy because they asked out a former patient or a former coworker or something.
I understand, and I'm not sure that's the intent of this statute, because when we think about our mission to protect the public, we are thinking about situations where a doctor uses their advantage of being the patient's doctor to sexually harass or engage in sexual activity with the patient when the patient is unwilling. I don't think this specifically speaks to consensual relationships between patient and doctor, although that's typically frowned on just as a general thing. I mean, I don't feel one way or the other about it, because I think that our licensees are intelligent and understanding. And, you know, if you felt like you had a patient that you wanted to have a relationship with, you would refer them to another doctor. They would no longer be your patient, you know, that kind of thing. So do we need another statute like that to tie into this, you know, that kind of thing? I mean, there's a few different approaches I think that could be taken. But again, if we could just wait till Ms. Baskin comes back, I'd really prefer to have her opinion or her thoughts as to why she really wanted this statute, because I kind of thought it was okay the way it was.
Ms. Whalen's, this is Dr. Cohen. I totally agree, because each of them are very specific, where as we reach each of these things, we can envision what it might entail. The one that's left vague is unwelcome comment, because of the extreme degree of subjectivity involved in that.
Yeah.
What one person might determine as just innocent, another one could see as a highly unwelcome comment. So that would be my only concern about the way it's written. The rest of them are very, very clear about, we can envision what types of things would fall into those categories. Unwelcome comments opens it up to anything someone finds offensive that may not be meant that way. So that's the purpose of my asking the question.
I think that's a good point. Yeah.
Dr. Moffitt, do you mind waiting and revisiting this when Ms. Baskin returns?
No, I think what Dr. Cohen said is appropriate. And I also like the word non-consensual sexual advances. I think it's a little bit cleaner than the unwelcome. Because you might make a comment that is unwelcome and you don't know it until you make it. But a sexual advance, I guess, is a little bit more specific. So I don't know. Do you agree with that, Dr. Cohen?
Very much so. Thank you. That's perfect.
All right. I'll just put that.
And that's good for now. And then, of course, yeah, we'll wait to see what the council says. So.
Okay.
Of course, we don't mess with our board appointments. organization of the board, same powers and duties. I think I added.
Yeah, I'm moving forward here actually quite a
bit. Okay, I did add under powers and duties of the board, board may adopt policies and regulations necessary to carry out provisions of this chapter.
Yep.
I added that because every time I would like to do a substantive policy, Ms. Baskin strokes out legally because she always feels like we don't have the authority to do that. Most boards have general authority to do substantive policies. Like if you were to look at the medical board or some of the big boards, they already do policies all the time. They have tons and tons. It's a little bit tricky, and I understand why she feels that way, because if the board feels strongly enough that they need to make a policy or a substantive policy, they should just make a law. It's kind of her thought process. So I don't disagree with that, but sometimes I feel like we're kind of in between a rule and a statute, and so a policy to clarify something would be helpful. We may never use it, but it's one little sentence, so I'm hoping that maybe the board will consider that.
I think it looks fine.
Okay.
Any comments? Anybody else?
All right. So my question under 32.17.06 for the use of our pharmaceutical agents, again, after speaking with AZOA, and we're not making any scope expansions, but I'm curious.
I don't know where you went, Margaret. Oh, I see.
I'm on page 7.
Okay. My
So I highlighted this because I wanted to know the oral antifungal, the oral antimetabolite, oral immunosuppressives. Those are all on Schedule 3, I believe.
Well,
I could be wrong.
The schedules are only for opioids.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, well, there's a non opioid part of Schedule 3 though.
Mm.
There's like a controlled substance and a non-controlled substance. They're all controlled, but they're not narcotics.
Right.
only because I was just thinking, like, to clean up the statute, and again, we can just leave it as is. I'm sure it's functioning fine. To just kind of put those, you know, just take them off and put them all under, you know, we can, under this statute right here where it just says we can prescribe, dispense and administer a Schedule III controlled or non-narcotic substance.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand your comment. So you want to remove those?
Well, it's not that I wanted to remove them. I was just wondering if there was a different way to classify them.
I kind of like them, actually.
You like it that way? Okay.
I will say that, like, the oral immunosuppressive, I mean, we have to be specific about that, of course, because we do have, you know, you can use steroids in a limited capacity, and you can use non-steroidals, also oral non-steroidals. So immunosuppressive is a too broad, or maybe okay. It should just come off. You know, we can't use, like, methotrexate and, you know, rheumatologic.
Well, I think that was my point, and it's not really my responsibility from the standpoint of, you know, I'm not the practitioner, the licensees are, but I get calls a lot asking, can I prescribe this drug or that drug? And then, I mean, you know, as the board, we don't like to specify that. I always just say, well, if it's on Schedule III, you can prescribe it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just a matter of, I mean, I've seen the DEA schedules. They're horrible to read. They're horrible to look at. So I was just feeling like if we could shorten the list of these drugs that we shall not prescribe, it would be helpful, but we don't have to. I mean, I do like it the way it is. I just felt like if there was something in here that we already have authority.
I kind of like it. Yeah, I like that it's specific, at least for my opinion. How about anybody else? I kind of like the list.
This is Dr. Cohen. I like the list as well. The only one was item 2 in section E about the immunosuppressive, because I don't want to beat a dead horse, but the comment about corticosteroids do have an effect of suppressing the immune system.
Yeah.
So
so do non-steroidals.
Right. So I don't know if it should say with the exception of.
I was just going to say that same thing. Yeah, I think it should say with the exception of, you know,
steroids
as stated previously in whatever, wherever we spell that out, exactly how you can use a steroid and non-steroidal, the time frame, the dosage.
With the exception of what?
So we have, I don't have it in front of me, I'd have to look for it, but we have specifically in the statutes where a non-steroidal and a steroid can be used, but they're only under certain conditions and for a certain length of time. Like, I think the steroid is usually like a week to 2 weeks, and it has to be, obviously, I don't.
Yeah, that's in.
I'm not sure where it is, but it's in here somewhere.
Oh, hold on. It's right here. Okay, so.
Steroids in the amount, that does not exceed the amount packaged for a single course of therapy if not more than 7 days.
So,
it's just above it, isn't it? I found it in the statutes.
It's on page 11 and 3217.28.
This is Dr. Cohen. I have a question about that, because now we have steroidal agents that are being used in the ongoing treatment of ocular surface disease and dry eyes, that even the prescribed amount is 2 weeks. Just talking about intermittently treating for an acute. Are we running into a problem if the standard of care is 2 weeks of treatment and we are limited to 1 week? These are some newer advances that have come up.
I didn't hear part of your comment, Dr. Cohen, so I kind of
said that we now have under steroids, which says limitation of 1 week, we now have some agents and some treatments, like, for example, FDA-approved medications for the treatments of ocular surface disease and dry eyes, that the course is 2 weeks on the medication.
Are you talking an oral or a topical?
Were you just citing back about the oral treatment?
Yeah, I was. This only refers to orals.
Okay. Then I withdraw. Thank you.
Okay. I think your comment, Margaret, with the exception of non-steroidal, and it needs to say steroidal, because we can use steroids for the course of a week. Let me see here. Steroids in an amount that does not exceed the amount packaged for a single course of therapy of not more than 7 days. So
Yeah, pursuant to the statute, we'll cover that.
Uh-huh. Okay, perfect.
So it's kind of like you look here, it's directed to the other, right, and that finishes out
yep.
what you're...
You've got it. Okay. I think that's perfect.
All right. And so the rest we're leaving as is, correct? Those are underlined. They're just the green tells me that's a fragment.
Okay. Yep.
Right.
Okay. I think all that looks good.
Yeah, that's nothing has changed since we're not expanding scope. Okay, so the licensing section here, so the this is the general statute. So, of course, who it doesn't affect, no dispensing of kitchens, the qualifications of an applicant. Section A, the first, I'm on page 8, Dr. Moffitt.
Yep.
A person of good moral character is removed pursuant to House Bill 2612 that removed that requirement.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll just say an applicant for licensure who wishes to engage shall meet the requirements of Section 32.17.24 and file with the board a verified application.
Mm-hmm. I didn't have any issues there. Anybody?
Okay. So here are some changes that I've made because this law, again, was probably last changed in 1999 or 2000. It's very antiquated. Keeping up with trends in the industry and the profession as far as licensure and mobility is concerned, we have a lot more mobility, of course, than ever. Also, the governor's initiative for expedient licensure that was part of the universal recognition applications. So some of my changes are from that. And also, I did reach out to Dr. Alicia Feiss, who's the dean of optometry at Midwestern University, and met with her regarding some of the curriculum equivalencies, like what's currently being taught versus what our statute has, some of the national board requirements that they teach. So she basically said that they teach to the curriculum and not to the level of like the national boards. I hope I'm saying that right. What she meant by that was, you know, they are teaching lasers and all that kind of thing, even if the state board doesn't have that in our statute. So I just wanted to clarify that. So I think it's clear someone needs to be a doctoral graduate that teaches the profession of optometry that's accredited. Not be guilty of an act of unprofessional conduct or any other conduct that would be grounds for refusal.
Should it say, Margaret, in number one, be a doctoral graduate of a recognized school of optometry? Should it just say of an accredited school of optometry?
Sure. Perfect.
Does it need to say, like, in the U.S. or is...
I know, because I know we're thinking of the same thing there.
So by default, it's actually U.S. and Canadian schools. If you look at ASCO's website, the Association of Schools and Colleges of Optometry and ACOE, that is who they mostly give accreditation to, and Puerto Rico. So there's currently 16 optometry schools. There's been a couple new ones that have been added. They're all in the U.S., Canada, and Puerto Rico. So if they ever go outside the U.S. and start accrediting schools, we would just accept them because they are the standard accreditation.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Sure.
Yeah, because by saying U.S. or Canadian, it really limits just in the event that they have accredited another school that's outside, like maybe in Mexico or, you know, someplace, some other country that we would accept.
Okay.
So this next part, excuse me, and that's that 1999 date that I was talking about. If the applicant graduated from a recognized school of optometry prior to August 31st, 1999, provide documentation of satisfactory completion of an equivalent course of study. So I think Dr. Feiss felt that the curriculum has maybe had a major change, like in 2005 when the lasers were added. But other than that, the didactic education is pretty standard from what it was then. And she said that currently a person needs 254 credit hours to graduate. When I think about our 120 hours
of requirements.
Maybe we just don't have the hours anymore. They have to
Well, that's okay. So, yeah, so I had, so we looked at the didactic education. We looked at this law together, Dr. Feist and I, and made a couple of observations. So she said that 60 hours of pharmacology is what the current requirement is. So it's interesting that that number has always been 120. We call that the magic number around here. So people that are endorsing, it only applies to endorsement candidates. So the new graduates are getting 60 hours of pharmacology as part of their, actually, as part of that 254 hours. So I felt like the 120 hours may or may not be relevant, and this is where you guys come in. I know you're not as familiar with, like, the curriculum itself, but when I'm talking about meeting the equivalency because to the national boards, because that's what we're talking about, because Dr. Feist had indicated that, you know, taking part one of the national boards would serve absolutely no purpose for a longtime practitioner. And so having the equivalency to the national boards is important, but it's not kind of the be all end all, I think, for that particular section is what she was saying. And I kind of agreed with that. That was my question to her is, you know, you have a doctor who graduated in 1978, 1982, 1986. They didn't take all parts of the national boards. Part three wasn't around then, or the TMOD wasn't around. What would the equivalency be? So I kind of felt like the word contemporary sort of meets that. So whatever the contemporary requirement is, sort of implies or indicates that it is whatever the current curriculum is. So based on that information, I felt like I wanted to remove the 120-hour requirement altogether because I didn't feel like it was
Do we want it to say 60 pharmacology hours? Like, is that the goal? Because are we just trying to make sure that they're up on their pharmacology? I mean, that's part of what number is, right?
I mean, honestly, yes, it's the pharmacology, but it is the didactic education altogether. I mean, I cannot imagine that any doctor coming in doesn't have a very similar didactic and clinical training.
When they take when we have someone who doesn't need that, though, we usually have them take that course, and it's pretty much all about pharmacology, right?
Right.
And aren't we trying to make sure that they can do therapeutics in a standardized way, right? That they're up on
they're coming up to our scope.
So as far as I'm concerned, if we're trying to meet that, maybe we just make sure that they've got 60 hours of pharmacology and otherwise they take the course. And with regard to MBEO, I would suggest that it says they have passed all of their MBEO exams. That's what I think. Those are my thoughts on that.
Well, the thing about that is endorsement candidates do not have to have the MBEO scores. That's the whole purpose of endorsement, is that they're not coming in with the exam. So this is just the general statute that allows us to require a certain amount of hours or a certain thing that they have to come in. The other one is addressed in rule, which will have to change once the statute changes.
Well, I think we should be specific about the pharmacology element, because what we're really trying to avoid is grandfathering in old practitioners who have not had enough pharmacology training and then getting a, you know, therapeutics license. So I think that that probably should be said. That's my thought on that.
Okay.
So if they're currently doing 60, then that's maybe our standard. And I wouldn't mind if I was licensing in another state and I had 50 in my training and they wanted me to take a pharmacology class, I would have no problem with that. It's just a refresher. We all have to take CE all the time, so I don't think that's a big deal.
Okay.
So if that's the standard, then.
I would like to hear from the other board members,
yes,
if I may. Thoughts on that? Anybody who, like Dr. Mascaris, do you seem to be able to
agree
with that?
Yeah, I think that it's based on the pharmacology requirement and what's new and latest, greatest. So I would go with what the optometry school provided, which is the 60 hours. Yeah.
Okay. And is it either or,
or is it and? Because this one, you know, originally the law said either meets the contemporary requirements or.
Which is the either or. And I think it should say specifically 60 hours in pharmacology.
Okay. Okay, I forgot I wanted to. Keeping in the same language here. I'm sorry, did you say it was either or it's and?
Well, so I have to read the sentence, I guess, here.
Because I feel like that's a conflict if you're saying if it meets the contemporary education requirements and then you're saying, but it has to total at least 60 hours.
Right. Yeah. Well, so they've either done this class or they went to a school with 60 hours, 60 pharmacology.
I'm going to leave this one then. So we want to keep that. Okay. Current language. Okay. Perfect.
So instead of and that either, right, it should just say or, and then there's the list. You either.
Well, yeah, it'll either meet the contemporary or it'll total 60 hours. Okay. My question is actually from Ms. Baskin.
Yes.
So I'm looking at striking number 4, documentation of successful passage of a written exam as prescribed by the board. I had a note saying, does this include or exclude the NVEO? Because that, I think, was when we had a practical exam. But I don't want to strike it if it will imply that we don't require the national boards.
Yeah, it kind of it appears that it would. And
it does. I have
a question about that.
So we need to leave that then.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So, and I hate to interrupt, but it's 9:48, and we said that we would start moving on at that point.
Okay, no problem.
Okay.
Unstrike that real quick. Okay. All right, so I'll... make a note, start here, for our next meeting. Everyone okay with ending here so we can set up our next meeting date? Okay. I'll stop sharing my screen. Give me 1 second. Oops. Okay.
Okay. So then I'm going to move on to agenda item G, Executive Director's Report. Future agenda items.
Are there any future agenda items anybody would like aside from the statutes and rules? Okay. Future board meeting dates. I'm still looking at October 7th, and that would be the regular time of 9 a.m. For a regular meeting. I will have 2 or 3 complaints that have been received since before this meeting. And then we will continue our discussion on the statutes and rules.
Okay.
And then,
is that date okay with everybody?
Okay. I do have plans to be out of town that day. I'm kind of waiting to see what our schedule is going to be to see if I can just log in remotely, but do I need to be there in order for there to be a quorum?
You can always call in. It depends who else is or isn't there. We need at least 4 for a quorum. So if you don't show up and everybody else shows up, we're fine. If you don't show up and someone else doesn't show up, then we don't have a quorum.
Okay. I'll work towards being able to do that, but I can touch base with everybody and make sure we have a quorum.
Okay, and then my next meeting after that to finish out the year would be December because Marie, I don't know if you know, I think what's the deadline for the submission for the legislation? It's either the middle of October or the beginning of November. I can't remember specifically. So October 7th would be our last meeting to discuss the
statutes.
The statutes and rules. The statutes, excuse me, not the rules. Do we have
an estimated time? So I know if I'm working that data, how much time to block out?
Madam President, I mean, we can meet at 8 a.m. again if you'd like. I was thinking, you know, more of like a 9 to noonish kind of meeting.
Well, go ahead, Mark. I didn't interrupt you.
No, that's okay. I just think it's really important to get through these. We're making good progress and it should move pretty quickly, but just in case, I really want to make sure that I have the board's review and approval before I move forward with anything.
Is it easier for the board members if we start at 8? Does that give you an extra hour with less interference from clinic? What are the thoughts on an 8 a.m. start? I could do either. I want it to be easy for the board. So each of you, please give your preference, 8 or 9.
Yeah, this Dr. Cohen, I could do either. It's just a matter of how much time I need to block out.
Okay.
I'm fine with either.
I'm also fine with either.
Okay. Dr. Carpenter?
So I agree. I'm fine with either one. Yeah.
Okay.
But you're traveling, so hopefully we'll have a quorum. Okay.
Yeah.
So October 7th at 8 a.m. then, Madam President, is that?
Yep, that works for me. Did you say 8 a.m. or 9 a.m.?
8 a.m., correct.
Okay, fine here.
Okay, so Friday, October 7th. That's a Friday, right?
Yep,
I've got it right. At 8 a.m., and then I would be looking at December 2nd to finish out our calendar year.
Okay.
That would be a regular 9 a.m. meeting.
I think so, too. Yeah, just give us a little extra time in case we need to, if we're trying to get through the statutes. I think the 8 a.m. on the next one is smart, but 9 is fine for the most part,
okay.
In my opinion.
All right, no problem. So I to reiterate or to rehash, Friday, October 7th, 8 a.m., just like this, virtual, and then December 2nd, Friday, December 2nd at 9 a.m., regular time, and that will also be virtual.
Okay, great. All right, then. So I think that's all of your items. Is that right, Margaret?
Yes, that concludes my director's report, Madam Chair.
Okay. And so then I'll call to the public. Any comments from the public?
Dr. Meyer, Marie.
Okay. I hear no comments. Would anyone like to make a motion to adjourn?
Is Dr. Cohen, I make a motion to adjourn.
Is there a second?
Dr. Carpenter, I'll second that.
Okay. Any further discussion? Okay. We'll vote. We've had a motion to adjourn. Dr. Galan, how do you vote? I'm sorry. Ms. Galan, did I say Dr. Galan?
Okay.
I apologize. I heard it later.
Aye.
Okay. Dr. Carpenter?
Aye.
Dr. Cohen?
Aye.
Dr. Mastores?
Aye.
I also vote aye. Motion passes 5-0. So this concludes our September 2nd meeting of the Arizona State Board of Optometry at 9:54.
And as a side comment to Ms. Whalen and to Dr. Moffitt, great job on running meetings. A lot of material covered and thought it was very well done.
Thank you, Dr. Cohen.
And Dr. Cohen, we'd like to be on that beach with you.
Oh, no. Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
Come back to reality on Monday.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good weekend, everyone. Bye.
Bye now.